So I'm here actually on behalf of a group of collaborators from Massachusetts, Connecticut, Colorado, and Texas, all very interested in corrections health research. And we have no conflicts of interest to disclose. So self-injurious behavior, and I hope I'm not preaching to the converted here, typically includes things like cutting, burning, hitting, headbanging, ingesting and inserting foreign objects. It also includes self-amputation and enucleation, but it doesn't tend to include tattooing, piercing, or autoerotic behavior. Deliberate self-injurious behavior, which we call SIBS, is typically distinct from suicidal behavior and usually lacks lethal intent, though despite that lack of intent, it can be fatal. And in correctional settings, self-injurious behavior does differ in situational context, in intent and incidence, and in environmental impact compared to non-correctional settings. The management of self-injurious behavior or inmates who exhibit this behavior consume significant clinical and custodial resources, and there are lots of serious consequences, health and safety, operations and custodial, even obviously increased costs associated with this, injury to the inmate, injury to other inmates and custodial staff. If an inmate needs to be escorted out of the prison for medical care, there's often a freeze in facility operations. There's a lot of increased security risks, a lot of staff diversion to that area, and often some concerns about escape attempts. A lot of studies have noted that there's limited information about what the characteristics and the prevalence are about inmates exhibiting self-injurious behavior in correctional settings. And to the best of our search techniques, we couldn't find any national assessments of self-injurious behavior in the U.S. prison system. And so that was our goal. We wanted to determine and seek out information about the prevalence and the nature of SIBS in the nation's prison systems and what interventions are being used to manage inmates, with the goal that this information would potentially be really helpful to both clinicians and administrators in their efforts to reduce the number of incidents, to reduce the severity of them, to improve the functional status of inmates. So using very traditional survey methodology, we identified the state and the federal directors of correctional mental health in the 50 states and the one federal prison system. And using all sorts of ways to try and gather the information, we used paper-based mail surveys, contacted them via email, had online data collection available to them. And we used a 30-item survey which elicited information about their definition of self-injurious behavior, the frequency of these attempts, how much they tracked data and what impact the events had on both operations and resources. We asked about diagnoses of inmates and different management techniques that they used. And we collected the data between last November and this past March. We did supplement our primary data collection with two secondary sources. We gathered data from the U.S. Department of Justice's Bureau of Justice Statistics to get both census data as well as operational and design capacity data as a measure of crowding, hypothesizing that increased crowding might be related to increased incidence of self-injurious behavior. And we also collected data from the National Association of State Budget Officers, getting some crude estimates of capital and non-capital expenditures, hypothesizing that there might be a negative correlation, that increased resources might be related to decreased incidence of self-injurious behavior. We used very traditional univariate statistics to describe the events, and the bivariate statistics we were mostly interested in were looking at the relationship between these incidents and characteristics of the inmates and prison size, geographic location of the prison, as well as crowding and expenditures. Of the 51 mental health directors that we surveyed, we got a response rate of 77%, which we were both very pleased and surprised about, considering that correctional settings aren't known for releasing a lot of information outside of their facility. Non-response wasn't related to our four variables of interest, the prison size, geography, crowding, or expenditures, and the respondents were very evenly distributed. We heard from all different prison sizes and states across the nation. When we asked them about what data they maintained outside of completing incident reports, were there any formal systems in place, you can see that actually just over half of the systems say that they maintained some data systematically, which means that just under half of the systems don't maintain data at all systematically. And when we think about sort of the epidemiology of this and the basic factors of person, place, and time, we asked a lot of whether they collected information on the different characteristics of the inmates, the environment the inmate was in, information about the sentence or the crime, the precipitance of the behavior, and you can see these numbers are relatively low out of the 39 systems that we're reporting. There's a lot of variability in what data they collect and how much they collect. When we asked them about their definition of self-injurious behavior, we found also a lot of variability. In fact, only a third of the systems actually have a policy in place that defines this behavior. Whoops. Sorry about that. But yet, 3/4 of the system, 74%, actually say that they do distinguish between self-injurious behavior and suicidal behavior. But when we looked at a very high-level content analysis of their definition, some of the definitions explicitly include suicide attempts, some of them explicitly exclude suicide attempts. Some of them say that the injury has to be severe enough to warrant medical attention. So there was a lot of variability in how they were defined. And when we actually looked at the prevalence, and all of this data, I should have said, is from 2008, both the primary data collection and the secondary sources, we asked people about calendar year 2008 data. From a denominator standpoint, we had systems reporting, which ranged from a low of 2,000. There were a number of small systems, small states, rural frontier states that don't have that many inmates in their state system, to a high of over 200,000 inmates. And so equally wide was the range of how many inmates engaging in self-injurious behavior were estimated by the mental health directors, which then relayed to obviously a pretty wide range in terms of from less than 1% to almost 9% of inmates engaging in this behavior. So on average, there's somewhere in the vicinity of 1% to 2% of inmates are engaging in self-injurious behavior, though despite that number being relatively low, the frequency with which they engage in this behavior is pretty high. 85% of the mental health directors say that these events are occurring at least weekly, and in 20% of the systems, they say that these events are occurring at least daily, if more than multiple times a day. Where do they occur? Well, we asked the systems to rank order from general population units all the way up to supermax facilities, and not surprisingly, segregated and lockdown units had the highest rates of occurrence. And among the general population units, higher rates were found in maximum security twofold compared to non-maximum security units. When we asked them about what extent these impacted operations and resources, in nearly half of the systems, the mental health directors report that there is at least a moderate, if not severe, impact on how much it disrupts facility operations. And in 70% of the cases, they report that there's at least a moderate, if not serious, drain on mental health resources. The literature clearly says that there's a lot of mental health diagnoses among inmates engaging in self-injurious behavior, and so we asked about the prevalence of these different diagnoses, the most common one reported being cluster B personality disorders, followed by mood and mixed personality disorders. And lastly, when we asked them about different management techniques that they have in their systems and different interventions that are used, there's also a huge amount of variability. Most systems have medications in place, usually SSRIs, followed by antipsychotics and anticonvulsants. In nearly all of the systems, and 94% of them, they say that they actually have involuntary medication policies in place. My apologies again. But most of them are actually used fairly infrequently, less than 5% of the time. All of the systems say that they have policies and procedures in place for the use of security and mental health ordered restraints, but again, those are also used fairly infrequently. And lastly, about half of the systems actually have a behavioral management unit or program in their system, but the bed sizes range tremendously from 15 to 620. So what does this all mean? Well, we think that our high response rate actually attests to the perceived importance of self-injurious behavior as a problem facing prison systems, though the lack of a widely and consistently used definition certainly makes it difficult to do research in this area, coupled with the fact that prison systems keep limited, if any, tracked data about it. It certainly adds to the challenge. As you can see, or as I showed, there was a relatively small proportion of inmates who are responsible for very frequent incidents of self-injurious behavior, which is viewed as being fairly disruptive to the operations and mental health resources. So it certainly adds to the note that this is a problem facing many prison systems today. The management approaches lack widespread consistency, and perhaps there's some heterogeneity to the underlying causes for this behavior. And interventions such as restraints and medications and behavioral intervention or behavioral management units are not used very frequently. Obviously, there are some limitations, as there are in any study. The mental health directors in corrections that we surveyed clearly are pretty knowledgeable about all of the questions that we asked on this survey, but the absence of track data certainly suggests that their responses could be viewed as being impressionistic. There is a consistent lack of definition, so we could be measuring different phenomena. It is self-reported data. It could be biased a little bit. In fact, one example was we asked about the extent to which the mental health services as well as the custodial staff were very cooperative versus being conflictive and how they managed inmates with self-injurious behavior. And two of the co-investigators on this study are former statewide mental health directors in their state's correction system, and they expected the results to be fairly conflictive. And in fact, only one of the 39 states said that there was any conflict at all between the mental health staff and the custodial staff. So They rated it as being fairly cooperative, so the self-reported data certainly lends a little thought to how to interpret this. And clearly we have some small samples here. There's only a finite number of states plus the federal system. I didn't mention before, probably should have, that when we looked at the bivariate level, none of the relationships between these different incidents and factors around the incidents were related to size of the prison, to geography, to crowding, or to the resources available to them, but probably we didn't power this to do that kind of study, but probably didn't have enough power to be able to find those differences if in fact there are correlates of those. We think there are at least two next steps that need to be done. One is to get a more complete and accurate reporting of data so that we can fully explore what the epidemiology is of self-injurious behavior. And certainly there needs to be some longitudinal study that looks at outcomes of those inmates who are admitted voluntarily or involuntarily to behavioral management units within the system. Outcomes such as whether or not over time there's a decreased number of incidents, a decrease in the severity, a decrease in the need to transport inmates for medical treatment outside of the facilities, which would be a huge cost savings to the system. There are lots of outcomes that could be studied. So in conclusion, self-injurious behavior has lots of consequences. There's a relatively small number of inmates responsible for a lot of events. Little is known about the epidemiology. And since there are wide differences in how systems manage self-injurious behavior, it suggests that there might be a lack of a best practice model. When we asked systems if they would be willing to participate with us further in more empirical studies and to provide contact information to us separate from the survey data so that we could maintain the confidentiality of that data, 85% of the systems reported and gave us additional information. And so I think that suggests the willingness of the systems to participate in future research underscores the need for that research and a greater understanding of what the root causes are and ways to intervene. And I wanted to end with these probably fairly graphic pictures here. These are from a 2005 article in the American Journal of Public Health. Actually, the whole issue that month was dedicated to prison health. And this tells the story of a gentleman who's in a supermax facility in Pennsylvania who does a lot of artwork, both about his environment and about himself. And he talks a lot about the devastating effects of prisons on the mental health of its inmates. And I put these here because I think it's really hard with dry data, which we've been presenting up until this point, to really get a sense of what it's like to deal with self-injurious behavior in prisons, incidents that, like, I've never seen before, I've never heard of before. And I think what doesn't get captured here in this study, and probably would be really hard to capture in any other study, is what the mental health directors say conveys a disproportionate number of incidents is the whole issue of communication and negotiation. What inmates do to their bodies as a form of protest, what they do to their bodies in terms of it's the only leverage they have to get what they want, that whole issue of communication is something that would be really hard to capture, but something that probably can't be ignored as we look at this, these factors and what the interventions might be to try and reduce them. So, thank you very much for your attention. Great.
Thank you for that great talk describing a problem that's not been so well described before. So now I'd like to open the floor to discussion, and I hope those of you who have questions will ask them, and those of you who just want to say something will say it. Go ahead, and if you could say it loudly so everybody can hear it.
Yes, my question is for Dr. Ventures. Great talk. I enjoyed last year as well.
Good to see you.
One of my concerns is work you're doing with the ICE NGO Task Force is the disparity in female patient outcomes and experiences. You know, anecdotally, my limited experience, with upstate New York, the men were in Batavia, a federal facility with U.S. Public Health Service providers, and the women, were out in a variety of county jails with varying levels of cultural competency, let alone translation capabilities. And I just wanted to hear, how we're moving forward on that task force. Attention.
So good to see you again, Cap. It's glad you came. Thank you. I think that in the pantheon of special populations where we've carved out, we need special communication about. So mental health and women's health are the two groups that are really at the top of the list. So I recently worked on a case of a woman who had dysfunctional uterine bleeding who was in a small county jail for months with. Not seeing a specialist on the outside with, lawyers kind of like protesting and trying to move things up the chain of command. And she spent like 5 months until she finally saw a specialist outside the facility. And I think that you're exactly right that there's this conundrum of people need special care, but then also people are in such a variety of settings that it's hard for DHS to make a special women's healthcare place or one special mental health place. And so I think that my hope is the medical classification actually tool that's being rolled out has several triggers in it for common gynecological, certainly OB, but gynecological diagnoses that trigger up classification of somebody. And then those detainees need to be in a setting where a greater level of services are available. So I share your concern. I think that women's health along with mental health are the two areas where we're keen to see, does this classification bias what we thought it was going to get us?
Yeah. Just a quick question, is the percentage of women in the ICE detention system sort of similar to that we find in the general US system?
I think it's a little more. I think that it's, because I think that, I don't know nationally for corrections what the percentage is. Is it 10? Yeah, so I think that ICE is a little bit more than that.
Sort of more like 15 or 20?
I think that's right, yeah, like below 20, I think.
I don't have an answer, but that was a good question. But I do work with ICE, and I will say that we have one facility that has been transitioned over to female facilities. So we have recognized the
right, and I think that that's a challenge of that Homeland Security and ICE face is that you have these PHS officers that are great clinicians. You have resources that you can centralize in some places, but at the end of the day, if any given day you've got 32,000 people in your system that are spread out over 270 spots, this is one of the challenges of turning on a classification system. You turn on that classification system in the whole system, and you're going to find thousands and thousands of people who need a service that you've got one or two places designated for. And so it's a really vexing administrative challenge as to how do you get the people the services that you just found out, boom, you're supposed to get to.
Bobby.
Dr. Satterfield, and everybody enjoyed the presentation. I think your investigators were right, and the facilities did not give a appropriate answers to the question of how much conflict there was. These people have worked in these places, and they know it. And that's very important, I think, in terms of the quality of your other data. So I'm interested in two things. One, if you have any longitudinal data where the other time you described in Massachusetts, you know, and two, whether you thought about including questions about diagnosis and punitive segregation and the etiology of self-injured behavior. And the third one, and this one is still the case, how does this compare with the non-incarcerated population?
So, let's see. The first question, I don't think we have longitudinal data. And we're actually, there's an RFA out right now from NIMH, which is due at the end of this month, that we're submitting an application to. And perhaps all of you are also submitting something, because it's particular around inmates with mental health illness in the justice system. And so we're hoping to actually do a longitudinal study, partnering with three or four other states to be able to look at that. I don't know at all how this compares to the non-incarcerated population. And we were really limited by the people who were part of the group, a larger group actually, that developed this study in terms of what we felt we could really ask the systems and get them to share with us. We were really surprised at the response rate. We didn't anticipate this much at all, and so we were really limited in what we could ask, and asked probably fairly high-level questions, and there were lots of great detailed questions that we'd love to know as a result of just having this.
Nancy. What do you mean when you say you were limited in what you could ask? Limited?
Well, the people who work in this Division of Corrections Health, who themselves have been doing a lot of this research, and not necessarily just self-injurious behavior, but a lot of research, really felt like we didn't expect much of a response rate at all, and felt that, and we got guidance from a number of state corrections, former correctional mental health directors, in terms of what they would be willing to answer or not. Many of these, the reason we had a 6-month data collection period, which sounds like a lot for an N of 51, many of these systems actually had to go up a chain of command before they could fill out the survey. The 6 refusals we had, it was 6 non-respondents, the 6 refusals actually contacted us and said, we'd love to participate, but won't allow us to send you the survey. So there's just a lot of hesitation in any of the reporting.
Let me ask Clemens, would you want to talk, Clemens, for a second? As an internist, can you associate the incarceration asthma, can you postulate a biological relationship there as an internist physician, maybe from your knowledge of asthma as well as previous publications that you kindly sent to me?
So there's been biological sort of mechanisms posited for the sort of association between psychological stress and the impacts that it has on asthma outcomes. One specific, I mean, there's a handful, but we'll just talk about two. You know, with the catecholamine responses that we sort of see, it's been shown to sort of be associated with an allostatic load, which can decrease immune function, increase the risk of infections, and worsen asthma risk. In addition, you know, there's some evidence that ties sociologic sort of stress and stress-related injury at the individual level to parasympathetic responses, and an increase in the parasympathetic tone can directly impact skeletal muscle and sort of smooth muscle contraction, not skeletal, smooth muscle contraction in the lungs and worsen asthma directly. So those are a couple of the mechanisms that could do it. From the standpoint of just thinking broader about incarceration and asthma outcomes, clearly, you know, huge amounts, and part of what we do at the Transitions Clinic is sort of create the link initially following release so that they can refill medications, get access to the delivery of care. And part of that addresses a lot of the fragmentation and sort of the difficulties these patients have when they come back to their communities and have to reintegrate. You know, the other additional family dysfunction, the social cohesion, and things that may inhibit their capacity to refill medications, engage in care, and do a lot of these things, as well as the competing priorities face, are other mechanisms through which incarceration could worsen asthma outcomes. Our facility.
Rikers is smoke-free, but 70% of the people who come in self-identify as smokers.
So are you implying that there's a to describe that relationship again, because I think when people think about incarceration, they're going to think about smokers. And I know you spoke to that relationship there. Could you summarize that? And is there any caveat in the relationships that you found if there was no relationship?
Between smoking and asthma? I think, or between incarceration and sort of how it might result in asthma outcomes. Well, what we looked at was we used kind of the simplest way is to say that incarceration leads to asthma, sort of stating that up front, assuming that if you add smoking to the model and it decreases the impact of incarceration on asthma, you could assume that it's either a confounder to the effect of incarceration and asthma, or a mediator, meaning increased people who are incarcerated smoke at a higher rate, and that's what leads to the increased outcomes in asthma. We found that when we added smoking to the model, it had no effect on the impact of incarceration. So it's an independent, the association is independent of smoking in that realm. So that's kind of more of a statistical causality. I think that's clearly, you know, following release, that's one of the major sort of risk factors for worsening asthma outcomes. In this study in particular, they didn't ask about incarceration within 2 weeks of these symptoms. They asked, have you ever been incarcerated? So it's really hard to tease out that difference based on our study. But I think the mechanism you're bringing out clearly is a reason for actually early intervention, you know, and there's been some studies done looking at the smoking, sort of non-smoking laws in prisons and how it impacts smoking rates and post-release and things along that lines. And we don't want to get into all of that, but, you know, obviously the early intervention, which is what we do at Transitions Clinic, and addressing smoking is a critical sort of point to focus on.
There was another question.
We didn't, you know, that's something that we could actually add to the model, but we didn't specifically model access to care in it. I think that a lot of the socioeconomic indicators that we use probably model fairly closely to that, but that's not something we looked at in particular, but it's a great point, something we should probably address.
In regards to the self-injurious behavior, you may have thought of this, but I'll just share with you that we once did a national study on the health status of soon-to-be-released inmates. And the first cut at it was contacting the Departments of Corrections using the same pen as you had. And our review panel thought that the data were inaccurate. And indeed, when we went to the individual facility level of asking about the state policy and the data, there was often no, or you know what, goes out in the field of what the central office thinks is going on, and sometimes be very different. So I'd encourage the funding is there to go to the local level.
Absolutely.
Nancy?
I'd just like to support what, for those of you who don't know, I hear from the National Commission on Correctional Health here from my own work.
Can you speak up, please?
Oh, I was just saying, my name is Nancy Stoller from UC Stanford. But from my own field work in different prisons and jails, I would support this statement strongly that what you get from the state is very different than what might be happening inside the institution. But I also wanted to follow up with some questions about your study. One of them is, there were no questions about what were the locations that the prisoners were in who were involved in this self-injurious behavior. And although in your final slide you really address the question of what is it that's happening to people inside that might be causing them to engage in this behavior. So I'm thinking of that.
Speak to them again,
as another issue that you might want to address. But the second thing is in Europe, people use the term self-harm to refer to these self-injurious behaviors and suicide attempts and suicide. And I'm interested that
separated this out, and there's nothing in your study that addresses the relationship between this and suicide attempts. And I'm just curious about why you don't link these things. I think it's our sense that there is a lot of research that has been done on suicide attempts and suicide within jails and prisons and so on. And so could you just say a little bit about why you separated these out?
I probably myself can't answer that question. I would bet any of these other four people could, in terms of thinking that there was something about distinctly about what might be the correlates of this separate from behavior that has a lethal intent to it, that really wanting to understand this separate from it. But I don't know why they would distinguish them when clearly there are some links between them.
I just think that inside a correctional institution, there's people, custodial staff or mental health or other health staff see the behavior as non-connected to suicide or suicidal intent. They're more likely to see it as a behavioral problem or as a sign of hostility or, like you said, or maybe as an attempt to get out. So doing a study in which publishing the results in a way that doesn't link these issues, to me, kind of further encourages people to think that self-injurious behavior is just kind of a willful behavior that prisoners engage in. So I'm just concerned about how it will be presented in treatment.
I'll ask. Okay, it's a great question.
Bobby, just behind you, and then you, your question.
I was just wondering, with the asthma study, did you look at the environmental factors that may exacerbate or even have someone diagnosed who's not previously diagnosed as an asthmatic based on the environment within some of the facilities in terms of dust and mold or just on the heat? Or different types of conditions that may prompt them to have an asthma attack.
So I guess the first point is that as a cross-sectional study, it's really hard to sort of say, you know, when the exposure took place prior to the onset of the asthma symptoms. So it's really hard to answer that question. And there were limited questions on the environmental, sort of physical environment type issues. And
you know,
a lot of the studies that have been done looking at physical environment collect that information directly rather than from surveys. In this regard, they did ask questions on whether they've had exposure to rats and things, and they may correlate with cockroaches or other sort of environmental things, but we weren't able to directly adjust for a lot of the things that you're talking about, indoor allergens, you know, outdoor exposures to, you know, pollution or different things, because they didn't ask the people those questions.
Bobby?
I just want to reinforce Nancy's thing. You don't need to reinforce it, just for the, because, you know, such people within facilities are categorized, humiliated, they're called cutters, they're called swallowers, they're not treated as a legitimate person. You know that, but that's, and I think Nancy's point, which is just a little restatement, is that facilities do have to collect information on suicide attempts and on and judge things as non-suicide attempts, and they're monitored internally and externally on how they do that. So there's a very strong bias to not call things suicidal attempts, and obviously so that's a real issue which I hope you'll try to gather in your study design. And of course, Nancy, and we're all concerned with people being categorized as cutters and then not being seen as suicidal. And it's my experience that people who are called malingerers are in trouble once they're in a facility, because they're serious, you know, calls for help are not going to be heard. And so this is you have the same problem. I can tell from your last slide and the presentation that you want to be able to get support for this population. But I think the failure to collect the data that some of the quality of the data that you collect probably reflects the difficult problems you have to help us all solve.
Well, thank you all for coming, and thank you to the three speakers. get the schedule so you can come to our next session, so we'll see each other there. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you, guys.